title we have here is Wither, our Nuclear Future. We thought that was vague enough that it would allow a variety of positions and interests to get expressed and a variety of topics to be put on the table. And that's certainly what we hope happens tonight. The genesis of the forum really was with one half of the two people who will be opening up the discussion tonight. Glenn Mogelson, most of you have met. On my right here is a nuclear physicist himself, works at Los Alamos National Laboratory in fusion physics research, and has spent a lot of time thinking about the issue of alternative choices that we have to make about our energy future and about broader issues of technology and our culture, technology and our attitudes toward technology. So as we've been sort of talking off and on about a variety of interconnected topics that that Glenn is going to be introducing, and then we'll turn it over to what I trust will be at least another perspective on some similar kinds of questions of technology and values, questions of nuclear power from a value perspective. Tim Kieschnick, most of you have seen Tim most often, probably with his literal other hat on, as the chief cook of the village. Tim is a multi-dimensional contributor to Holden. Not only does he cook our wonderful fare here, but he is a musician. He is a peace activist of long standing. He is a tax resister, and we may talk about that at some point. He's certainly someone who has thought long and hard about the value dimensions of the nuclear directions our culture is going in, and about technology and values. So we're going to ask Glenn and Tim to lead off with about 5 minutes of posing the questions, posing some points of view, and then we'll open it up. Glenn Mogelson first. Thanks for suggesting this. Get us into it.
Well, the first area that I want, well, before I start, I appreciate having the opportunity to be here and to talk to you. I am really interested in getting feedback about your feelings. Being a scientist and being in a community of scientists, it's difficult to get other people's perspectives, that is, people who aren't scientifically oriented. Now, with that in mind, the first issue is what is our energy future? What do we want to do? And what are our possibilities? We have oil, we have coal, we have solar energy, we have hydro energy, we have the possibility of geothermal energy, and we have nuclear energy. And those are the only ones I could think of. I guess there is also wind power in a very limited sense. And I want to mention just a few things about each of those. The oil energy, I guess, comes direct, the most direct way in which that is used by our society is in our automobiles. And there's a risk associated with that. We've become very used to using automobiles, so we don't think about it. The risk is the effect that the use of oil can have on our atmosphere. And we really do not know what has happened over the last 50 to 75 years as a result of the use of that energy. We're studying it. The consequences are the following, at least as I understand it. It's not an area of my expertise, but things that I've heard about. One of the consequences is climatic changes. Another consequence is something that most of you, or a lot of people, worry about: radiation. And the radiation is a result of the fact that the atmosphere is changing. and allows a greater amount of radiation from the sun to come in. And so those are the risks. The next one is coal. And probably many of you have heard about acid rain. So coal, the risk is, as it is right now anyway, is the possibility of the consequences of acid rain, the destruction of streams and lakes and forests and plant life and everything within those areas. That is the fish, the vegetation. So those are the risks. Solar energy. Passive solar energy, I don't know enough about to know whether there are any risks with it. I don't think there's probably been enough research to know if there's risks. Some of the types of large solar bases that I've heard explained do have risks associated with them. Now, let me mention briefly what these kinds of systems are. One of them that I'm aware of captures solar energy above the atmosphere so that you don't have all of the absorption from the atmosphere. And it catches it in a very broad system and then beams down the energy onto the Earth. And the idea is to have a number of these systems located throughout the world, or throughout the, not the world, but the atmosphere, above the atmosphere, actually, beaming down energy. Now that poses, again, atmospheric problems and a lot of understanding. So there's risks in that kind of thing. And other risks that are associated just with the unknowns of what, you know, what's involved, what chemicals are involved, and how you actually have a solar energy system that provides energy for places like New York. Geothermal is another area that's a very research orientation right now. It's a very limited source of energy. And it's, again, an area that is so new that I don't think we have any idea of what the risks are involved in that. Here in Washington, we have hydropower. And you might ask, I don't know if you've asked yourself this, you know, in the process of creating a hydropower system, you typically dam a river, a major river, if you need a lot of power. And that causes quite a bit of a difference in the orientation of the land that was once there, a difference in the water and probably, at least in the local area, the climate and the vegetation. In addition to that, I don't know if you've asked yourself questions like this. I didn't ask myself until I got here and started thinking about this. How long does a hydro plant last? And what are the risks? That is, most of these dams that have been built are only, I don't know, what, 40, 50 years old? How long do they last? And do they withstand a catastrophic event? Something that happened in Colorado, for example, the big Thompson River incident. So how safe are they? Do you really know? I don't. And of course, the last one is nuclear energy. And there's one nuclear energy source that's available. It's fission. And I think there's a lot of talk about the nuclear energy in Washington. It's an area that has been discussed in the media extensively. And so it has a lot of hype, and I don't quite understand exactly why. Radiation is light. The radiation from nuclear energy certainly can hurt people if you're exposed to it. But there are other ways of being exposed to it also, other forms of radiation that hurt you. But it is dangerous. It has risks. There's no doubt about that. There as all of these are. For example, the meltdown that occurred in Russia is a very good example of that kind of risk. The area that I'm most familiar with is fusion energy, and fission is the breaking apart. Fusion is the combining of, in this case, deuterium and tritium. Fusion is something that is for our great grandchildren, probably, or our grandchildren anyway, for most of us here, if in fact it ever occurs. And that's another source of energy which has risks. Of course, they're not known entirely because there isn't a fusion plant. But there is radioactive materials that you're using. It doesn't have a meltdown possibility because of the way, at least in the area that I'm in, inertial confinement fusion, because it's a situation where you need to explode a little target maybe once a second or 10 times a second, and if the target's not there, or the beam, in this case a laser beam or a heavy ion beam, isn't there, nothing happens. you get nothing. Anyway, so that's a quick picture of all of the sources of energy that I'm familiar with that are possibilities for our children and their children. And the thing that I try to emphasize here is that there's a risk associated with all of them. And they're different. There's different risks associated for each one of them. But to assume that there's not risk, I think, is a mistake. And you really need to think about it more carefully and study about what the risk may be and decide. So that's one area. The second area that fascinates me is technology. And what I wanted to do to start out is to kind of get a feeling for your background. How many of you have studied physics or taken a course in physics in college? Raise your hand. Okay, that's pretty good. How many of you have studied or taken a course in literature? Raise your hand. Okay. Very good. How about mathematics? Calculus. How many of you know what calculus is? Mathematics, just regular mathematics. Okay. Now, how many of you can fix your car? Raise your hand.
Depends on what's wrong with it.
Okay, I mean, do pretty major work on your car. Okay. Did I see any women?
I can do my motorcycle because I can see all the parts and I have an excellent manual. And okay. The car is just so
that's good
hard
enough.
To reach.
How many of you know how your light bulb works? Yeah, how many of you know how your light bulb works? Okay, great. Keep your hands up for a second so I can see. Okay, very good. this is for the women. How many of the women here this is for men and women. I put my daughter down here, so that was a mistake. How many men or women could, if they had an electric stove, could tell their daughter how the electric stove worked? Do that? That's still pretty good. Why am I asking these questions? I didn't know how to do a number of those things until after I got my degree in physics. Turned out I was a theoretical physicist. But my concern is fear of technology and where the fear is coming from. And let me introduce some things now and after I've asked you those questions, kind of feel in your gut, what are you sensing? When I tell you some of the things that that relate to my experience as a scientist familiar with some of the technology that's being developed. When I was in Germany, I learned that they're developing, they have these beams, ion beams, particle beams. They're 10 to the minus 5. How many know what 10 to the minus 5? Okay, I'll describe that in a second. A beam with a radius of 10 to the minus 5 centimeters welding a microchip. Okay, and now what is 10 to the minus 5? An example of the size of 10 to the minus 5 is the tip of a pin, roughly. Okay, a beam that tiny, welding. Okay, that's an example. In Los Alamos, they're developing lasers. The lasers have a power of a trillion watts. Now, typically, your light bulb is 100 watts, or 50 watts, 60 watts, a trillion watts. Los Alamos has a huge computing facility, one of the largest in the world. And it's being used to mimic things like the explosions in nuclear weapons, things that happen in a reactor, atmospheric conditions, the solar atmosphere and the solar wind, things that are going on in the solar atmosphere and solar wind. Particle beams, this is something that you may see in the future. Particle beams are being developed in radiography. You know, all of you get your x-rays all of you get images of your body now using x-rays. In the future, they may also have particle beams where they can image a tumor in your head or somewhere in the back of your rib and see it quite clearly, much more clearly than you ever could with an x-ray. Communication. it's now possible, and I think most of us have felt this, it's now possible for a bank to have access to your financial record, at least in some areas anyway, to go financial record for almost anyone. And that's going to continue. And there's a whole, you know, communication has just exploded. You know, communication with the whole world. Lasers are being used for surgery, removing gallbladders. We're in a world where genetic engineering looks like a possibility in agriculture. Animals and plants and drugs. And so that's just a quick view of some of the things that I've seen. And the thing that I ask you is, are you afraid of some of the things that I've mentioned? Do they worry you? Do they bother you? And if they do, why?
Let's hear from Tim for a couple of minutes and then deal with some of the questions that you've laid out, Glenn. Thank you. This is really, I think, partly a conversation that reprises the sort of seminal work by C.P. Snow on two cultures. This is a question that has been alive in Western society, certainly for the last 50 years. That is, how does the scientific culture talk with the culture which is more broadly defined by humanities, by liberal arts, by even social sciences, particularly the conversation between hard scientists and the rest of us. Tim is one of the rest of us.
Just folks.
Just folks. Do you want to use your own way of getting into these questions for a couple minutes, and then we'll open it up?
I think what I have is basically a summary of my answer to that last question, of the questions, are you afraid of these things and why? And then I can finish up with four new questions that are raised by my answers to those questions. What I've been thinking about primarily in this connection is the relationship between science and technology and morality and ethics. Certainly, science and technology are good, valuable gifts from God, the things for us to really value highly. And there's nothing inherently wrong with them. But our society has run into some really serious problems, as I think we've tended to give science and technology a bit too much free rein to develop in whichever directions they happen to go, and to implement whatever science and technology develop. We've tended to leave technology to expert scientists and morality to expert theologians and seminary professors. And as a result, we failed to consistently and adequately ask the question, is this a good and appropriate use of God's gift to us, God's gift of science and technology? We need to ask that of each kind of technology, each thing that's developed. And I think that the nuclear societies that we're a part of today failed to ask that question as it applies to this incredible onslaught of new technologies and new products and new science areas that we're experiencing. This failure has resulted in and been caused by both three closely related problems. The first is that technology, I think, has sometimes rushed ahead of itself. One example of this that comes to my mind right away is the Trinity experiment, which was the first time an atomic bomb was exploded in New Mexico before Hiroshima and Nagasaki when they were testing it. And some of the main scientists involved in that before the test explosion were taking out bets on whether or not the entire southwest of the United States would be vaporized. They weren't, you know, they didn't know. They knew there were a number of possibilities, and they weren't sure, but they were willing to go along with the test, even though they weren't quite caught up with themselves. Another example of this, I think, is in nuclear power, which I guess I'm the first thing that I don't know much about. I guess it's fission, which brings up all the wastes. And we know how to create nuclear power, or electricity in a nuclear power plant in such a way as to produce wastes, but we don't quite know what to do with the wastes yet. But that hasn't stopped us from going ahead and doing it and producing all these wastes before we know what to do with them. So technology is sort of rushing ahead of itself. The second problem related to our failure to ask the question about what is appropriate technology is that the technology has rushed ahead of morality. Again, the first atomic bombs, when the bomb was exploded in Hiroshima, some of the people involved in developing that bomb, these two examples from here I'm getting from a film called The Day After Trinity that we had up here several years ago. And there was a person who was one of the people who developed it, and he said that as word came through that the bomb had exploded in Hiroshima, that there was almost unanimous feeling that a lot of people involved in it had the same two initial reactions. Their first reaction when they heard the news that the bomb had exploded was relief, it worked, because they were all afraid it was going to be a big dud. And that would be very embarrassing, and they wouldn't know what to do after that. So they immediately felt this relief. And then right after that, they thought, oh my God, what have we done? And that was the first time for most of them that the morality question had entered into it, that they had wondered from a moral side about the implications of this incredible new weapon that they were creating, so that technology had rushed ahead and then left the morality behind it. I think a main contributor to this, getting bigger and bigger and bigger contributor to this problem, is the existence of corporations as non-moral units. When I think it was Continental Airlines was doing most of the business for the INS, shipping Guatemalans and Salvadoran refugees back to their home countries where they were often imprisoned and or executed. And there was a big protest saying Continental Airlines should stop doing this. And I remember reading a newspaper article in which a Continental spokesperson said, Continental Airlines is not a moral entity. You know, we'll make a decision on economic grounds or something like that, but we won't make any kind of decision on the basis of whether it's moral or not. And so we see that same kind of non-moral entity thinking coming into play in all kinds of areas of technology, so that Boeing, for instance, can make cruise missiles without wondering whether or not a cruise missile is a moral thing to have around, because it's not the business of Boeing to deal with morality. It's the business of Boeing to deal with economics and the profit margin and things like that. And so the morality kind of gets left behind as the technology forges ahead. And the third problem that I see related to this, the question of appropriate technology, is very closely related to the other two, and that's that our morality is lagging behind the technology. It's not just that technology is shooting ahead, but it's that the morality is sort of stagnating or moving off in unrelated directions. The institutions that we've traditionally relied on to stimulate our moral thinking have really lagged behind, and they've tended to ignore and, at the very least, not understand technologies that are already existing and that are already being implemented, and much less the ones that are to come. Most Christian denominations are still relying primarily on the just war tradition to deal with deciding whether or not wars are moral. And that's a tradition that was developed a long, long time ago, when people were still fighting each other with spears and bows and arrows and swords. And these churches are trying to apply that system of ethics to Trident submarines. And it's just, the connection is not making it. The morality needs to adapt to these new kinds of technologies. Obviously, the technologies are raising all kinds of new moral questions, but we're still trying to apply the old ethical systems. So the basic problem that I see is that technology and ethics tend to move in separate spheres, isolated from each other. Both fields are dominated by very narrowly focused, highly specialized, quote-unquote, expert men. And I say men really intentionally there. What does, we tend to think of mostly seminary professors, actually, as the moralists and ethicists who tend to give our society guidance in terms of morals and ethics. Maybe we don't tend to think of that, but that, I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, what does a typical seminary professor know about nuclear fusion? Not very much. So how can a seminary professor deal with the ethical questions raised by something like nuclear fusion when he or she doesn't know what nuclear fusion is? On the other hand, what does the typical nuclear technician know about the writings of St. Augustine or Karl Barth, or about vicarious propitiation? You know? See, these two places are highly specialized, and they're operating in completely separate spheres, and they can't talk to each other. And then thirdly, what does the typical person, most of us in this room, what do we know about either of those? Not much. They seem just too heady and too complex and too far removed from our lives for us to understand either of them. The two fields require such specialization that it's nigh on impossible for any one person to have the time, much less the energy or the willingness or the capacity to deal with both of those fields. It's hard enough just to learn a little bit about one of those fields. So, as I see it, the problem is certainly not that we have science and technology. It's not that we have advanced science and technology any more than the problem is that we have theology and ethics. The problem is that the theologians and the ethicists are not adequately informed or influenced by the scientists and technicians. And also the other way around, that the scientists and technicians aren't adequately informed and influenced by the theologians and ethicists. So, I'd like to pose four questions then. First, should we, or how can we, slow down the development, or at least the implementation of this of the new technologies, so that our ethics can have a chance to catch up with them? Or second, how can we redirect or speed up our ethics to respond more relevantly to the technology that's coming out? And third, and this is maybe the key question that I have, how can we better integrate the advance of science and technology with the advance of morality and ethics? And finally, we lay people are told over and over and over again that we should leave both technology and ethics to the experts. And so my question is, should we do that?
Well, there are a lot of things on the table here. Let me suggest that we have a meeting ground for the discussion, which I think we should move into right away. If we're talking about C.P. Snow's Two Cultures, or at least a 1986 version of that question with the scientific and technical experts on the one hand, it was interesting that all of your risks, Glenn, were defined scientifically and technically. They were not defined socially, politically, economically, morally, ethically, right? Different. We could think about risks in different categories than scientific risks, right? And on the other hand, the sort of the isolation of the ethical experts that Tim was talking to. It seems to me that the meeting ground where most of us are in this room is a meeting ground called citizenship, right? Where in fact these are absolutely necessary elements of discussion among informed citizens in a democracy. And perhaps the problem underlying that both Glenn and Tim are pointing to is that citizens somehow are not included in either of these expert streams, let alone they themselves becoming the crossing point, the point at which public discussion of science and ethics happens. So let's make a little start on a citizenship journey here tonight. Talking with both sides of the question, raising some fears and some reactions to the questions that posed by both Glenn and Tim. Where are folks? How about the fear question? Fear question is on the table first.
What is the fear or risk of solar? Like, we have solar in our home. We have it a year. Mm-hmm. And I can say it sure took our gas bill down in the summer. But what is the risk of solar in our home?
I really don't know. I'm not. Is it a regular, is it a passive solar system?
Mm-hmm.
Passive is just to have a wall that is oriented toward the sun.
Yeah, it's got a big deal on our roof. And it's something pointing toward the sun. Okay. And then it's connected to our water heater. And it just affects our water heater.
I don't know if there is any risk. What I'm saying is that for something like that, it's always, it's a supplementary kind of thing, depending on where you live. If you're living in New Mexico, there's a possibility or possibly Southern California also. Or if you're living in Washington or Wisconsin, or you're in a really large city, that's not adequate. You need some other kind of energy source. And some of the things that would be adequate that are solar do have risk. And I mentioned one example of that. For your situation, I really don't know. I don't have enough background in that area.
I say it sure is
after
a gas bill.
Yeah.
I kept track for the year previous to our getting it, and then we put it on and it hasn't paid for itself yet, but
how about some more general kinds of fears about the technology?
In general, the level of concentration of the energy, the risk will go in proportion to the concentration. The idea of a nuclear power plant where you can run a city for a year on something that you could hold in your hand, that implies that there's a tremendous concentration, and if that gets out of control, you're in trouble. Solar power is very diluted, and it doesn't create extremely high temperatures. The risks are proportionally lower.
I guess the only example that I can think of right off that you have to be careful about is the reason that it becomes a problem is that the effect, like the gasoline is an example of a situation where you don't have an isolation of energy, but energy is being used, and its effect is very difficult figure out, because it's not a dramatic effect. It's going to occur instantaneously, basically, on the time scale. It's an effect that occurs over years. It could be 100, 200,000 years, who knows? But it could have a much more dramatic impact on the world than even a nuclear accident. And, so I agree with you, but it depends to one point. But it's a different kind of risk. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess my fear is that we as a society have an insatiable desire and lust for energy, and that our whole society is based on that energy. Our productivity, our balance of payments, everything we do is based on that energy, and that we as a society are not willing to cut back on our energy, independent of the cost, not dollar-wise, but independent of what it means to morality or legality or whatever.
Or to the future, one of the moral questions, to the future generation, to your children and their children's children. I was very disappointed in driving from New Mexico to Washington, because I was disappointed because almost no one now drives the speed limit. It was dangerous in most places to drive 55 miles an hour because most people were going 65. There's no more oil shortage. So, you know, people disregard it, and it's true for the law enforcement also. They just ignore it, clearly.
One of my fears is that much of the advance in science is driven not so much by, at least from my perception, not so much by pure knowledge, but by the sense of funds to the research. And to give an example, you mentioned, for instance, the ability to diagnose certain illnesses in the body or to image certain things. I remember there at Los Alamos, there was a big piece to do about how they could treat cancer with a linear accelerator. But I always thought that was sort of ludicrous, because to build I don't know how many millions of dollars, it cost $100 million accelerator, it's mainly used for expense purposes. And once in a while, stick in a cancer patient for disaster and cancer stuff.
What has happened? A spin-off of that. See, that's another part that about science that's not understood, I don't think. There's a lot of things that become a spin-off. No. My old supervisor at Argonne National Laboratory is working on developing an accelerator which is small and capable of being put into hospitals throughout the United States that could be used for this purpose. But it's, again, a research direction, and it's a new thing. I'm not sure that it's possible yet, but it looks like it is, and I think it will be funded. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, the main purpose of the accelerator was military, but a spin-off from that could be very beneficial. But I agree with you. I think that the government does spend too much money on the military. The problem is that our society doesn't spend money on research. Okay? That's, you know, our industries should be spending money on research. That's a terrible problem for our country, because that's just been decreasing over the last 20 years, in my mind anyway. Somebody asked me a question about that directly, I'll go into that. But that's a concern of mine.
Government funds to research have been cut back to markets, and they're not.
Yes.
Is that really an indication of how people feel? Does that come from the vote of the people?
I think
is that what the people are saying? Is that what your question arises out of? Is that what you see manifest
right.
in fear?
That's part of it. I mean, not only that, I mean, it comes in terms of where the government spends the money, and a lot of it isn't on research. That's for darn sure. The military money isn't spent on research. It's not very much of it. In addition to that, in the areas where industry is involved, there isn't any pressure to get the industry to spend money on research. And that's, of course, your problem, my problem, everyone's problem, in my mind.
It's certainly true that all research monies are down, and that proportionately the amount of research money that comes out of the military budget has gone up. I know three separate cases of research colleagues of mine in the hard sciences who had proposals to national funding sources turned down. We wrote the proposal to fit under the Star Wars rubric, under Strategic Defense Initiative, and resubmitted them, and they were all funded.
Scientists can be very clever.
No, absolutely.
I mean, they're doing the same research. They just wrote the proposal differently.
You have the same name, it's probably true about research, but some of the research projects that are being funded are ludicrous and a waste of money. You know, the sex life of a monkey or something, maybe there's some application, but there's some other things that are more ludicrous than that that are being, funded.
Proxmire, of course, Senator Proxmire is famous for finding his sort of goony project of the month like that. I sometimes think about that, though, just to throw in one comment about that, that kind of criticism, while sometimes right, is often based on the inability to see the difference between science and technology. That is, there are an awful lot of pure science projects that seem absolutely unconnected with any application. And technology is what applies science. Pure science is hard to get money for, whether in the social sciences or in the hard sciences. Sometimes what the public, I think, thinks about scientific research is based on the wish that all science had immediate payoff in the technological realm. Sometimes Proxmire, I think, sort of goes in that direction.
Yeah, I think Senator Proxmire does a lot of them with those things that he comes out with, because a lot of what he's pointing at is basic research. And that, in my mind, that has to be there. We have to have the basic knowledge. And even if it's learning for years, it's still knowledge that we have. And I think that he's playing a good game. I don't think it's fair.
Yeah.
Let me ask you. You're talking about the spin-off. I want to know how you deal with the possibility that what you're working on maybe a spin-off into nuclear weapons.
Question.
It's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah. The nuclear weapon situation, I hope I don't scare people too much, but I guess I will tell you this. It's, and I'm not sure this is true, this is only a vision that I have, that in the past, and for the years, for the last 20, 30 years, nuclear weapons have been pretty much tied to just a very few countries, the United States and the USSR. I see that as changing dramatically. That the possibility for nuclear weapons is going to multiply to many countries throughout the world.
It already has.
It already has to some extent, and it will increase. The reason for that is that the technology base for doing it is just available to many more countries. And the I think it's fortunate in one sense that the communication between countries is improving so dramatically. So an indirect response to to what you're saying, is that it bothers me. I see the nuclear weapons as a deterrent, but it's, I don't like that. It's a deterrent in the following sense, that whenever you face yourself, look at yourself clearly in a mirror. You're good and bad. If you're, the countries are like that. And unfortunately. And so many countries now have the possibility for nuclear weapons. There's the possibility of having one of those countries do something very frightful. And how do you, you know, how do you prevent that? Well, you can have disarmament, but then they would have to be involved. It would have to be an agreement between countries in a way that we are not familiar with right now. We would have to have much better communication and understanding. And I hope that's what I see happening. That I see as a necessity.
Tim pointed out an existing possibility. As a scientist, is there really any concern about slowing down technology? Is there a willingness really to say we have now to slow down, let a morality, or are they catch up? Is that really a possibility in your discipline?
I don't think it's, I think that there's something that should be clarified to begin with. When the atom bomb was created, there were people working on that project that right away knew after the test what they had done. And they were very concerned long before the Hiroshima accident.
Couldn't have been too long, there's only a couple of weeks, didn't it?
Well, there's a, as soon as it happened, there's a book by Feynman that just came out recently that talks about that a bit. And the books by Oppenheimer and other people. Einstein wrote to the president about the nuclear weapon, and he was very concerned about its use. So like in any situation, you have people that are concerned and worried and have a very strong moral attitude. Then you have people that don't care, and you have people that are just the opposite. At least that's kind of what I've seen. And so that is always, I think, from what I've read in genetic engineering and in my field, in most of the fields that I'm aware of. So there is a concern, but I think that there isn't, like you said, I think that people in science, and people in ethics, and you need to give input into the whole thing. That's one of the reasons why I'm here.
You're saying partly that it's not just a matter of the willingness of scientists to slow down.
Absolutely not.
That science is the result of the processes of production in society, in fact. And that's decisions of citizens, again, right?
Yeah.
We can decide what to spend the money on, where to spend the research dollars on.
And you should understand what would happen, okay? One of the things that I can see is that the United States, suppose the United States slows down. I mean, West Germany's not slowing down, Japan's not slowing down, China's not slowing down. What does it mean to us as a nation if we all of a sudden decide we're not going to be involved in technology? Okay,
we're
that's another thing.
But the motive we're driven by is this absolute fear. Right?
That's what I wanted to know. I don't think so. I hope not.
But you seem to indicate that the only time we'll come to grips with a solution is when the fear threshold gets so high between nations that we'll finally come to the point
okay.
of recognizing that we created an Einstein. Or a
that
Frankenstein.
Could.
Then we'll handle it then.
Unfortunately, I think that in the past, my experience with our country is of that type. I mean, you look at what happened during the oil embargo. Look at what's happened now. That is my vision of what happened in the oil embargo. Everybody really got mad. Some of the things that I heard on the bus just astounded me. People said, we should go into Saudi Arabia and just take over the country and take over the oil. The oil belongs to us. Okay? That was a common thing. And now people are all driving 65 and 70 miles an hour. I mean, we forget very quickly. And why is that? That's one of the things. Why do we do that?
Glenn, you were talking to begin with, I thought, about a general fear in the populace that's based on ignorance
yeah.
of science. This last bit of exchange seems to me to be about fear based on knowledge, in fact, right? And I think those are two very different things, and we ought not to confuse those
okay.
two things. Yeah.
You seem several of the points you made, a sense that I've been thinking about, and I'm thinking about knowledge, and I can certainly give you things to read that will counter the notion that citizens shouldn't participate, but they have to become experts, because a lot of people have been addressed by questions. And one of the writers, Kenneth Hammond, who poses a spectrum of six kind of, it's a shifting ratio of knowledge based on hard scientific data. And he really looks at physics and the very hardest of the hard sciences. And true experimentation in your laboratory in a controlled situation where you can look at the results and everyone can understand how those results were reached and they can be duplicated and there's no mystery in that. And even in that, the two posts at one end, there's some judgment involved in defining the question and so on. But maybe, let's say, now he doesn't assign numbers, but since I don't have this graph here, let's say that's a kind of 90-10 ratio. Then you get to the social sciences and have this kind of maybe 60-40 where you have quasi-experimentation, no real control, you're putting people's behavioral situations. And gradually this shift occurs, and about six steps later, you're in a mode of totally intuitive thinking. Now, without putting any value judgments in either of those extremes, the difference is, in the one case, we can all see the process and understand the variables. And in the other case, the kinds of processes are mysterious. And we can't even describe those for what's going on in our own mind. And his argument is that in a public policy-making situation, but we bring in scientists to answer questions as experts. We're taking them out of the laboratory situation, and we need to remember that. So that very quickly, they're moving across the spectrum and functioning like the rest of us, and trying to answer questions that are broad, as maybe society needs to pose the questions. They're not narrow technical questions. So it's as mysterious how their minds are working as how citizen minds are working. But we have this mystique that because they are trained in analytical thinking, they will apply that methodology in all contexts. And there's no evidence of that, or very little. And in my research, I interviewed scientists. I'm glad I did interview them. I'm glad I did them personally, because I'm continually touched by how sensitive they are about the narrow range of their knowledge. And if anything, being aware that they need this kind of, as I've been thinking of, value input. anything ethics and morality. But there, as the questions get posed on a societal level, they can't be answered by one person and one experiment. So we need this discussion, and we need the citizen participation to help them with addressing the value questions. And I think, if anything, they're seeking that, but there aren't, we need mechanisms.
Terrific. Thank you for that. Nice input.
I just wanted to kind of add to that. I work in medicine, and I've just stayed an off way that I work in cancer treatment, and what's been said about money being spent is really true. We haven't had a new good drug or a new therapeutic modality in cancer for 6 or 7 years. I mean, exposure in 60s and 70s, no, directly, but still directly related to government funding research. What I really wanted to say was that I think in some ways medicine poses more of a model where technology and ethics can get together. Medicine hasn't liked it, but it's happened anyway. We're now being regulated, and you can pull people in this room, and they don't know any more about how the kidney sorts out ions than they do about how a light bulb works, but they still very much take it upon themselves to regulate my profession, and I think it's been beneficial. We now have insurance companies telling people how much they can have, whether they can have a bone marrow transplantation or not, or whether they'll pay for it. We have bioethics committees in our hospitals. The day before I came, there was an 80-year-old man who had a disease of the bone marrow called myeloma, had a viral encephalitis with no hopes of recovery, and we had to make a decision as to whether or not we should keep him alive on a ventilator or not. And I could, because then why didn't I get back without any trouble at all? But other issues and ethics and family and everything came into play and decided to let him die. So I think that's possible. I don't think you need to have experts. I think you need to have, and I think if it's possible, bring these theories together in other areas of scientific endeavor.
Thank you. Fred?
Well, I think one of the things that is problematical, at least in my mind, is that with every technological advance, you have to consider the several heights. If you can do something positive with any piece of technology, you know that somebody has already figured out some way within a week of doing something decidedly negative. This may be one of the big problems that we have to face, I think, with our considering of how fast or slow we should go with technology. It's nice to have all the benefits for cancer research and all of that. But what do we do with the ability of that machine that zaps a cancer to zap a whole city, for example, because it just slipped in another lens? I think that may be what's making a lot of people very nervous about the technology. The good and the bad, the yin and the yang, go right together.
There's a fascinating, the counter side to that is not only Jekyll Hyde, but it's also Hyde and Jekyll. And in Albuquerque, there was a proposal for a while to use the nuclear waste to treat the sewage, so it would then all be killed and all the bacteria would be killed. And the only reason it wasn't funded was some technicality. But it seems to me that's just the opposite of what you just said, and it's also just as true that they take something which is inherently dangerous, probably, and try to make something good out of it in order to justify it.
I wonder whether we need to be sort of formally calling this to a halt. This is the kind of conversation that really ought to be continued through the days to come and can be informally. I wonder whether anybody has any thoughts on the church as a place where this sort of dialogue can go on. It does strike me as a place where under the affirmation of the gospel, scientists and non-scientists can talk about value questions, which is what the church is supposed to be dealing with. I then have been heartened by the recent formation at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, the Center for the Study of Religion and Science, which I think is the first at any of our Lutheran institutions. maybe something that our local congregations even ought to be thinking about, ways in which to broaden the values and citizens of time. Let's break it formally. Thank Glenn and Tim, and thank the rest of you.